Hello and welcome to Volume 132 of Capital Ideas Live. In today's issue, we'll discuss how to deter trespassers. We'll find out how not cutting your timber today can save taxes. We'll discuss whether the coronavirus could affect the wood business. And we'll learn how to effectively spot fungi on your forest land, if you're into that sort of thing. So this program is brought to you by the generous contribution of Forester Search, a service that makes it easier to connect forest landowners with consulting foresters. You can access the site through foresterssearch.com, or there's a link on this page. You'll be given a roster of consulting foresters who can guide you through the next steps that you'll be facing as a forest landowner. I'm Hayes Brown with the Alabama Forest Donors Association, and I'll be your host for today's discussion. Anthony Goodman is a neuroscience researcher at the University of Alabama at Birmingham, and he also leads the Alabama Mushroom Society. And we want to discuss his enthusiasm for mushrooms and how a landowner might get interested and involved in that topic. Hello, Anthony.
Hi, how's it going?
How do you begin to hunt for mushrooms on your property, and how do you do it in a safe manner?
Yeah, so unfortunately, a lot of us grew up hearing about how mushrooms are poisonous or even dangerous. So I want to go ahead and just put that aside and say that you can safely touch any mushroom as long as you aren't indiscriminately eating them. Now, Alabama holds six different ecoregions from the Piedmont to the Southern Coastal Plains, each home to an overlapping list of thousands of different species of fungi. Truly just an awesome biodiversity. And while that biodiversity is perfect for photographers, taxonomists, and, you know, our ecosystems, it creates kind of an energy barrier for those people who are interested in getting a handle on you know, what the heck that mushroom right over there is. And, of course, if something is edible. So the best way someone can begin to hunt for mushrooms on their land is to go out, take some pictures of, and since they're all safe to touch, go ahead and pick that mushroom. And there's a wealth of really excellent field guides and online resources that are just absolutely unbeatable. Now, interestingly, social media has actually provided one of the best tools for both quick identification and, in general, learning materials. So even our local Alabama Facebook page has world-class experts who are eager to compete with one another to help get your fungus ID'd. And I think that makes it a lot easier than digging through a book.
Now, how do you find edible mushrooms, though?
So let me start by saying that you're going to hear constantly from the mushroom community, don't eat anything you aren't 100% confident in the idea of. So with the wealth of resources at our disposal, it's easier now than ever to familiarize yourself with some of the more common and easy to ID gourmet mushrooms. So some of those include chanterelles, chicken of the woods, hen of the woods, morels, several boletes, lion's manes, oysters, the list goes on. And we at the Alabama Mushroom Society do our best to consolidate that information on these and several other easy-to-ID edible species on our webpage so that you can learn what you need to get started foraging for mushrooms. That information is going to include anything. Oh, go ahead.
Well, what? Tell me about the Alabama Mushroom Society. Do you all meet, and what do you do at your meetings?
Yeah, sure. So we meet, we have two chapters, one that meets in Birmingham and one down in Mobile. We have monthly meetings that are open to the public. And really what we do is we like to invite regional or national experts to speak on topics. Sometimes we're just chit-chatting at our meetings. But I think what most people are really interested in is actually getting out in the woods and foraging together. So, okay. You know, we're going to go out, ID things, and just kind of have a good time.
All right. Well, thanks, Anthony. We appreciate that.
Yeah.
Encountering trespassers on your land, especially during hunting season, is somewhat common, and how to deal with the situation without making it worse is a topic we wanted to discuss with Matt Weathers, section chief with the Alabama Department of Conservation and Natural Resources. Welcome, Matt.
Hi, Ace. How are you doing? Thanks for having me on.
Sure. Tell us how you distinguish between just a common trespasser and a person that's hunting without a permit, and what problems the two violations can cause on forest land.
Sure. for the landowner, the signs that are left behind may look identical. Someone crossing your land or just entering the land may to the lay person seem exactly the same, but to your local game warden, they're sort of telltale signs that are left behind that distinguish someone who's just simply crossing your property from someone who may be using it as a place to hunt. So for just simple trespass, some of the things to look for are just tracks or trash that are left behind. If someone is accessing your property for hunting, there may be some other things that you will find, like where they've used a climbing stand to climb a tree, or ground blinds left behind, or spent ammunition, that sort of thing. And those can cause problems for landowners in a couple of different ways, really. A trespasser on foot may not really leave a lot of damage behind. They may just leave some rubbish behind. But if someone's crossing your property or entering your property on an ATV or a four-wheel drive vehicle, something like that, they may do some serious damage to your roads or running over young planted timber, that sort of thing, which can cause a lot greater problem. Now, hunting without a permit may look similar. A hunter or a poacher may enter the property on a four-wheeler, but the problems that they induce are a little more serious sometimes. It delves into a public safety issue. If you don't know that person is on your property with a firearm hunting, someone could get hurt. It does fairly often happen.
What can you do to address the problems in a safe and legal manner?
Sure. Well, really, the first thing that we advise people about is just paying attention to your property. When you notice those signs, and it may be something as simple as, a gate that you find is secured in a different manner than which you typically secure it, take note of that. Game cameras are a great way to see who's using your property when you're not there. If you find that gate that is not secured in the way that you secure it, a $75 game camera can be there 24 hours a day just taking a look at that. That's a really safe, legal way to see what's going on in your property. And if it's vehicles accessing your roads, you can set those game cameras up, those exact same cameras, in a manner to take a picture of a tag number, or if it's an ATV at a height that gets a picture of the face of the person that's riding the ATV. Those are smart tools to use that keeps you from having to one-on-one interact with those trespassers.
If I find a trespasser, am I supposed to detain them and hold them until you get there? What's the best method of dealing with it?
No, we really don't ever recommend that. What we say is the best thing for you to do is just be a good witness. Cell phones, everybody carries them now, and smartphones with cameras are great. Just take a picture and just leave the area. We really suggest that you know your local conservation enforcement officer, your local game warden. We issue each of our guys, and there's officers in all of Alabama's 67 counties. We issue them cell phones, and we give those numbers out freely. For a landowner, that is a contact that you really need to have. If you see somebody hunting on your property or just trespassing your property, just call one of our guys. We'll come out there. If it's a hunting-related matter, we'll know it, and we'll take care of it. If it's just simple trespass, those things usually go to the sheriff's department, and we'll assist the landowner in making contact with our local sheriff's deputy and getting those issues resolved. Just you really never want to detain somebody. There's just really nothing worth the danger that puts you in.
All right. Okay. All right, Matt. Well, thank you for that. We appreciate it.
Absolutely.
The decision on when to cut timber is influenced by a variety of things, including your own needs, the maturity and condition of the trees themselves and the market. But Dr. Patrick Heisel of Clemson University can identify another factor in the timing of a timber sale. Hello, Dr. Heisel.
Hello, Hayes.
What are the options as you consider passing on timberland to your heirs from a tax standpoint?
All right. As you consider doing your estate planning and passing on your property to your heirs, I think there's two common options among many. One would be to pass on your property as a gift to your heirs. With that, on the tax side, there's a potential problem that the timber basis that you're going to have with that property when you pass it on as a gift will be the donor's adjusted basis, which means if you as a landowner owned your property for a long period of time, your timber basis is most likely going to be depleted You know, the longer you own it, so the heirs that will get the property will most likely have a very low timber basis, which means they may have to pay a higher amount of capital gains taxes when they finally get to do a harvest because of that low timber basis. The second option that you have is basically to pass on the property to the heirs as part of the inheritance. When that happens, the heirs will actually benefit from what we call a stepped-up timber basis. So the timber basis that the heirs will have is going to be the fair market value of the timber at the time of death of the previous owner, which can, you know, can be really great when you have mature timber, or it can be fairly low if it's freshly harvested timber.
Oh, what are the potential savings on capital gains tax when you pass on, as you pointed, mature timber that has increased in value over its lifetime? What's the scope and magnitude of the potential savings if you decide to pass it on to your heirs with this stepped-up basis?
All right, so if you try, so every forest, every land base is different, so it's going to change, you know, from one state to another and even within a state. But I run a very basic example on an average soil, you know, with a southern yellow pine plantation on it. And, you know, if the mature stand is passed on, so if somebody delays the harvest of mature timber and basically passes it on to the next generation, the heirs could potentially make an additional 30% on the money, or keep an additional 30% of the money from the timber sale. Now, that doesn't mean that their stumpage is going to be any higher. It only means that they pay lower capital gains taxes because they will have a much higher timber basis when they start out the harvest and everything.
More in the pocket.
More in the pocket.
But not your pocket, your heir's pocket.
Your
right?
heir's pocket. And that's it. And there's the difficulty here. You know, if you consider delaying your harvest and you may leave it for the heirs, you know, you have to consider if you can afford it yourself financially to just not harvest it and not make the money. But the second consideration is also biologically. Can the trees actually take it that you leave it for a few extra years and you pass it on? And you may have to consider doing an additional thinning. And what I would really strongly advise is to talk to a forestry professional to see what can be done if that forest stand in consideration can actually handle, you know, a delay in harvest. But I would also advise to talk to a tax professional to actually see if there's any other considerations, if there's actually a negative impact. You know, maybe the estate will be valued too high and there can be all kinds of other taxes that can be applied if you go over a certain value.
Okay. Well, thank you, Dr. Hussle. We appreciate that.
Thank you.
Pete Stewart's a returning guest in our markets chair. He's a brave person that's willing to make predictions about the future, and most recently his top 10 predictions for the global markets. Welcome back, Pete.
Thank you, Hayes.
The coronavirus caught us all by surprise, I think, but you've already mentioned in your top 10 predictions that global pulp markets will soften. Do you see any uptick in packaging and boxes as a result of the coronavirus?
Yes, and this is the danger of making predictions, right? But what we've seen over the last, say, 18 months or something is a real the recession on the industrial side of all sectors, including pulp and paper. And although anecdotally we are seeing demand for boxes in China and demand for delivery, say, in China, which was hit earliest by a coronavirus increase, and some of it in the U.S., we don't think that is particularly long-lived, but it certainly is helping, but it's not offsetting the kind of global oversupply of pulp fiber brought on by really new capacity in Brazil and Indonesia. So hope springs eternal. There's a little bump, but honestly, in the long run, I think we're still looking at a flat market pricing for pulp and pulpwood over the next year or so.
Okay. What about in the U.S. South, the sawtimber markets? How does that look for 2020?
Well, I think the verdict is still out a little bit. Our prediction was going to be reasonably soft, and the softness is because of an oversupply of saw timber. We were predicting demand for housing and lumber to be about flat or up just a little bit. So it'll really depend what happens to the general economy over the next 6 months to see if the coronavirus really impacts employment. Housing and construction is really directly related to the number of people employed. And if they're employed and making money, well, obviously they potentially will buy houses. What we're not seeing happening in this downturn, like what we saw in 2008, is credit markets have not frozen up. So credit is available, and that's certainly positive.
Okay. What about CLT, cross-laminated timber, and these engineered wood products?
You know, I think it's just it's such so early in this market that these new plants are very transactional in because, you know, there's one being built in Arkansas and there's a couple planned in the U.S., and I don't think anything stops those. Again, they're highly speculative to begin with, and a little bump in the or dip in the economy probably really doesn't change the trajectory of this.
Okay.
Look all over Europe. It's just a good example of what the CLT market might look like. If you look in Europe, CLT is everywhere. Almost all, I mean, a tremendous amount of new buildings are made out of some sort of engineered product. And I think that's the model we'll see in the U.S. over the next 15 to 20 years. But it'll be slow. It's not going to change the market in the next year or two, but
okay.
It will be a new demand that is very positive for timberland owners.
Okay. Well, thank you, Pete. We appreciate that. That's all the time we have for this issue. Thanks go to Anthony Goodman, Matt Weathers, Patrick Heisel, and Pete Stewart. Forest land can be considered an asset for some, although many plan on keeping it for their lifetime and passing it to their children. Watching the stock market go up 4% in one day and then down the next day may worry you or not, but timberland rarely has that kind of swing. So it's reassuring that while you may not consider timberland primarily an investment, it can smooth out a bumpy ride overall. I'm Hayes Brown. Thank you for joining us for this issue of Capital Ideas Live.